You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com. You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
It's Monday, October 31st, 2016. From Slate, it's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. And we now know the Republican hero of this election. Not for all of us, but to his party, the man who most helped the Republican Party. He is a member of Congress. He is a member of Congress, though he does such a poor job of campaigning, or at least did this time around, that he may not be a member of Congress in a few months. He's Daryl Issa. But what he did was to help Republican kind by putting FBI Director James Comey in the hot seat during judiciary hearings.
So isn't there a double standard that when you granted immunity to these five individuals, you took them out of the reach of prosecution for crimes committed related to destruction of documents or withholding or other crimes pursuant to congressional subpoenas?
I don't think anybody was given transactional immunity.
Oh, really? Now, we have not allowed to make your immunities public, but I'm going to take the privilege of making one part of it public. I read them. You gave immunity from destruction.
Now, Bob Goodlatte is the chairman of the Judiciary Committee, but Issa acted as chief prosecutor. His questioning over Comey's process clearly made Comey uncomfortable. Comey was on solid ground defending his decision, though he didn't want to be second-guessed based on how he conducted his investigation. And this whole thing, what Issa and the other Republicans were doing, is called working the refs. Now, at the time, I thought it was a pointless exercise. Comey just answered over and over again, I couldn't indict her because there was no intent. Yes, but without intent, there can be no indictment. No prosecutor would indict without intent. That is just how prosecutors work. So I thought the Republicans were all grandstanding. And they were, but there was something else. They were working him. They got to him. And last Friday, in an unusual move, Comey announced that he was once more looking into Hillary Clinton's emails. It would seem that any good prosecutor would look into the newest batch of emails, but what was optional and unusual is to announce this in a letter to Congress so close to the election. And I say Comey made the choice because Issa and the Republican media never let up on Comey. And that, my friends, is how the game is played. I'm not happy about it, but that's how the game is played. The idea that the Clintons are this nefarious couple who methodically eliminate potential headaches like those Vince Foster allegations. Well, let me tell you, Anthony Weiner walking the earth to this day, that is a staunch rebuttal to that argument. If anyone was going to get killed by crossing the Clintons, Weiner would have been floated out to sea a long time ago. That is not how the game is played, except in fiction, like in House of Cards and maybe Donald Trump's mind. How the game is really played is the piling on, the accrual of complaints, the badgering of the point, until the FBI director insists in a late October surprise, surprising even members of the Justice Department, insists that he just had to announce that this was part of his new investigation. Now, it's been said that it's not standard procedure. I don't know if it is or isn't. It seems like it's not the tradition for the Justice Department to announce an indictment or investigation on the eve of an election. But maybe it's not the tradition, except when it is the tradition. In 1992, Caspar Weinberger, Secretary of Defense, was indicted days before the election. Here is Vice Presidential candidate Al Gore, 24 years and one day ago.
We now have the evidence, the smoking gun memorandum, the clear proof that what George Bush has said about his role in creating one of the worst, most embarrassing catastrophes in American foreign policy is simply untrue. How can he now ask the American people to trust him?
This is how the game is played. Yeah, you can't pull a Tony on Christopher Moltisanti after the car accident, although Christopher did sit on Adriana's dog. You can't go to those lengths. The red flag should have been up months ago, years ago. Wiener is a problem. He likes himself shirtless too much. All the shirtless guys, anytime you see a guy that taken by his own shirtlessness, there is a problem. Wiener, Geraldo, Hulk Hogan, Putin, all shirtless, all dangerous. Wiener is a loser, and Hillary is going to take a big hit. I think the media loves this conflict, and we're not going to be sure about how it will all play out until days before the election. There's your October surprise, bleeding into a November headache. On the show today, I will be talking about, well, this tradition. Let's cue another Daryl Issa cut.
You were handing out like candy, according to some, immunity.
Yes, the handing out of candy, Halloween, and how we celebrate it, yet decry it, sort of like politics itself. But first, we're going to play an interview I did with Eric Zorn of the Chicago Tribune. And in this interview, we talk about two races, one a close congressional race and one a race for a Senate seat that actually isn't close. The incumbent Republican Mark Kirk is trailing heavily to Tammy Duckworth, the Democratic challenger. Now, this race was in the news recently because Mark Kirk responded to Tammy Duckworth in a debate by saying this about Duckworth's claim that her family fought for America going back to the Revolution.
I had forgotten that your parents came all the way from Thailand to serve George Washington.
Now, you should know, and the context is, even though Tammy Duckworth does have Thai ancestry on her mother's side, her father's family apparently does go back to the Revolutionary War here in the United States. Kirk somewhat apologized, but it was widely derided as another example of why Kirk isn't going to win this race. So what I learned, and what I hope you learn in this conversation with Zorn, which, by the way, took place in the Chicago Tribune's editorial board. I was sitting in what they call the Obama chair, which is the chair he sat in to receive the Trib's endorsement, although they did tell me the chairs probably switched around, but I was at least in the Obama place. And right there in that editorial room was where Duckworth and Kirk had done a debate a month ago. And in that debate, it became apparent something else was going on with Mark Kirk. You'll hear what that is right now. Here's my interview with Eric Zorn.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to LibsynAds.com now. That's LibsynAds.com.
You are.
I'm Eric Zorn, a columnist from the Chicago Tribune.
Illinois is a state which I think most experts, if you look at the polls, are saying will flip, will go from a Republican senator to a Democratic senator. First question is why?
Well, because this is a presidential election year, and tends to be in presidential election years that the state votes heavily Democratic. There's also an issue. We have Mark Kirk. He's a moderate Republican senator. He had a stroke in 2012, and there's a question out there as to how well recovered he is from that stroke. He's running against a disabled Iraqi war veteran, Tammy Duckworth, who's now a congresswoman. Generally, the voting trend suggests that, and the polls have suggested, that Duckworth is going to beat him based on the fact that it's going to be a blue wave in Illinois, and the fact that there are some questions about Kirk's ability to continue to be a senator.
And especially I saw Kirk in videos where he sat next to Duckworth, maybe here in this room that we're sitting in. Yeah, it is. And he didn't seem entirely incapacitated, but you could tell, I could tell, I thought that something was off.
Well, that's true. In the time when they came in here for a debate in this very room, and Kirk's answers were short and often not quite on point. And you can pull audio from that if you want, but it's a very interesting situation where they would, you know, Duckworth would hold the floor for a minute, minute and a half answer, and Kirk's answers were 20, 30 seconds, and they often sort of wandered away from what the questioner was asking him. And by the time I left the room, I was thinking, this guy is not fully there. And it's a very tough charge to make against someone because everyone admires Kirk's courage from coming back from the stroke. He worked really, really hard. There are lots of videos of him learning to climb stairs and so on. So to say that about him seems really harsh. On the other hand, being a U.S. senator is a really tough job. You really have to be totally engaged with the issues and totally there. And he has issued a letter from his doctor saying that he's perfectly fine. But, you know, you watch that video and you think, you know, is he really there? The other thing that's interesting about this is that there's sort of a traditional series of debates, televised debates, that Senate candidates do in Illinois. One of them is our local public television station. Another one is our local ABC affiliate. Kirk wasn't going to do any of those. He is not doing the public TV debate. He only is doing the ABC affiliate debate because I pressed him on it in this very conference that we had here. I said, you know, why aren't you doing this debate? And he sort of looked like he didn't know that he wasn't doing it. And he said, well, yeah, okay, we can do that. And that kind of forced his campaign into doing it. They're doing it very late. He's doing it very late in the cycle. There's a reason why a candidate who's running behind is eschewing debates. And I think it's because he doesn't do well in them anymore.
Has he done any events? What sort of campaigning has he done?
He's doing a lot of one-on-one. And I have to say, he did an interview just the other day on the local public radio station here, and he sounded really good. So it sounds to me like he's got good days and he's got bad days. So, you know, that is really an issue in this campaign. It's one that a lot of people don't want to touch. And I know that when I touched it in a column, I got people, you know, criticizing me like, oh, Dr. Zorn, you think you know how to, you know, you think you can tell better than his campaign people or better than his doctors. But there is an issue there.
Do you think the polls have moved since the debate in this room or whatever you called it? Do you think that people have saw for himself and made an evaluation?
There hasn't been a lot of polling in this race because Illinois is not one of those states that people are focusing on. I think everyone knows Hillary Clinton's going to win this state big. The polls I've seen have both shown Duckworth with a substantial lead. I think there's a lot of sympathy and a lot of respect for Mark Kirk. And Mark Kirk is the kind of senator that this state would embrace and has embraced. He's, like I say, he's a socially liberal Democrat, or sorry, Republican, you know, Freudian slip there almost. Mm-hmm. And you know, the editorial board here at our newspaper endorsed him 6 years ago, declined to endorse him this time for the reasons that we're talking about, that this question is he really up for the job? But he is the kind of Republican that this state tends to embrace. And the fact that it probably isn't, I think, is a tactical mistake on the part of the Republican Party, that they should have seen this coming. They should have realized that this is the guy. They probably should have said, you know, Mark, we really respect what you've done, but it's time for you to retire.
Is Tammy Duckworth a good candidate? I know she has this inspirational biography. She is, I think, a double amputee, and she has served as a member of Congress. But is she a good candidate? Is she a good public servant?
She's a better candidate than she was. She was not a great candidate when she was running for Congress. She had lost, and she won running for Congress. She's upped her game in terms of her presentation, on the issues and so on. Is she a great candidate? No, she's not a great candidate. Did she do much when she was in Congress? No, she didn't, but she was a Democrat in a Republican-controlled House. Not very many Democrats did much of anything. So there's still a question mark about what she can do and how she can do it, but she has broken with the party on some issues, and she's someone who I think, you know, we can look for decent things from. But again, if she's going to be in the minority in the Senate, she's not going to get much done, so.
There is a race in Congress here. I think it's Illinois' 6th district. It's Illinois' 10th district. And if you look at the Cook ratings of political races, they have about 12 that are pure toss-up. And the last I looked, this was a pure toss-up. And it's a seat where it was held by a Democrat. Now it's held by a Republican. And I see about 45 commercials per 30 minutes about this particular race on TV.
Yeah, it's very interesting because this is the seat that Mark Kirk held as a congressman before he went on to the Senate. It was won by a Republican, Bob Dole, then Brad Schneider beat him, and then Dole came back and beat him. This is their third matchup now. And the question is, what is the real difference between the two? And it basically seems to be a party label that they came in here for their debate, and they were arguing over the smallest points of disagreement between the two of them. One interesting thing about Dole and Kirk is I believe they're the only two Republicans who've been endorsed by the Human Rights Campaign, which is the National Gay Rights Organization. And of course, there's no difference between them and their Democratic opponents on gay rights, but the Human Rights Campaign feels like they need to encourage Republicans to support gay rights. So you've got these really socially moderate Republicans running, you know, and this district we're talking about is the North Shore of Chicago. It's a wealthy, very white district, and it tends to be very moderate in terms of its support of Republicans. For years, it was represented by John Porter, again, the sort of the classic, you know, liberal Republican. So you've got this race where there's the only difference between the two of them. I mean, they're like I say, small things on trade, small things on you know, the fine points of gun control, that kind of thing. So essentially, they've tried to make it into a referendum. The Democrats are trying to make it into a referendum on Trump.
Yeah.
And Dold was one of the first people to come out and renounce Trump, just like Mark Kirk has renounced Trump. They've both been strongly opposed to Trump. But because they're not out there every time Trump says something stupid, which would be like every day, they're not out there hammering Trump. The Democrats are saying, well, you're not distancing yourself enough from him. You're not actively out there campaigning for Hillary Clinton. And so there, you have these ads that are sort of absurd, like, you know, Bob Dole and Donald Trump are doing this. And it's just, you know.
Breathing, carbon-based life forms. But I also saw one where they said Dole went to an anti-Hillary fundraiser. And the facts were he went to a fundraiser that only gave money, not on the presidential level, but to local Republicans. But it was labeled Beat Hillary at the Distillery, because obviously that phrase rhymes, and they're trying to hang that around Dold's neck.
Well, just because you want Hillary Clinton to lose doesn't mean that you're, you know, four square behind Trump. And you know,
there's probably a lot of voters in that district who have that feeling.
And there are a lot of Republicans who are going to split their ticket on, and this is the kind of person that they're going for here. I mean, they were trying to have a bigger tent. They're trying to do through addition rather than subtraction. So yeah, the idea that he's not actually out there campaigning against Hillary Clinton is used against him. So you're seeing this inflation of rhetoric around these extremely moderate Republicans. And so this is what, you know, nationally, when they're talking about the races, that what's going to happen is they're going to distill the right wing in the Republican Party. You're going to get rid of people like Kirk and Dold. And then the right wing is going to have a firm hold on the Republicans. You're not going to have those moderating voices. Kirk talks about himself as the glue that holds the various sides together. You know, I don't know that's so true, but it is, I think, important to have people like that in Congress and this Democratic effort to get them all out. And I understand it as the end game, obviously, but this is, you are pushing the edges of the party.
Yeah. Although I remember when I was a kid, I built some model airplanes, and you use the glue in the middle, not only on the left wing of the plane. But what do you think about that philosophically? Would Democrats be better off just by flat out shrinking the number of Republicans in Congress? Or would they be better off, if they can't take over the House, to go against a Republican caucus that has moderates in it so that they can maybe make a deal with Paul Ryan? If you're only going against Republicans who are Tea Party and right, maybe there's no chance of ever achieving anything in Congress. It's like game theory.
I think you're exactly right, that when you have a party that's intransigent, that has no reason to reach across the aisle, then you're not going to get anything done. And that's what they're talking right now about the Supreme Court. Senators are saying, well, we're never going to approve any of the nominees that Hillary Clinton sends our way. You know, I mean, that kind of stuff is not what we're used to in our political tradition. The parties are supposed to come together. They're supposed to find some common ground and move forward. So you know, these people are the hope. These kind of people in the middle are the hope of the democratic process, small d. But you can certainly understand, you know, the short-term end game for both parties, which is get the other guys out of there, see if they can take as many seats as possible and use that as leverage.
I think good government types also say that with gerrymandering, you have all these safe districts. You don't have real races. You know, it's better for democracy to have real races. Well, here in Illinois' 10th, we have this real race. But what do you get? Democrat, then Republican, then Democrat, then Republican. Your congressman doesn't have any ability to, you know, build up seniority, which could help the district. Are you really, you know, half the time, half the voters are upset that they're not having their voice heard. Is this really an advertisement for what a great thing a competitive district is?
There's an argument that says that these uncompetitive districts are actually good for government because you can have people taking tough stands. When you have a district like the 10th where whoever wins that race is going to be thinking about 2 years from now right away, how is this vote going to play with these independent swing constituents? So you're going to develop really cautious legislators who aren't going to make those deals, who are going to be afraid to move. So yeah, you're right. It's a it's a problem when you have people who are skittish all the time because they're just afraid of the voters. You know, we'll see.
And I guess the last thing I would say is, from afar, I think it's all being fought, you said, as a proxy for Trumpism, and that label might not fit Dold fairly. So is that only because late in an election, the people have yet to decide are maybe the least informed voters? Or is it because that really is the best way to fight this race? I don't mean the best tactically, but that is, you know, the best argument against Dold, that he is part of a party that did embrace Trump.
That is the strong, Schneider's strongest argument against Dold, which is that, like I said, his party is running Donald Trump at the top of the ticket. And this is a problem for moderate Republicans all over the country, which is how does this tent of this party have this guy at the top who is such an absurd and offensive candidate? And I think that Dold and Mark Kirk also have admirably distanced themselves and adequately distanced themselves from Trump, that the voters can be sure that they're not going to be putting a rubber stamp in Congress if they, you know, for Trump if he wins. So I think they have done that, but this is the Democrats' best card to play, and they play it over and over again.
All right, Peoria City Council, fourth ward, what do you say?
It's a complete disaster.
Eric Zorn, he knows a lot about all things Illinois, especially Chicago. He is a columnist for the Chicago Tribune. All right, thank you, Eric.
Thanks, Mike.
Podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYN ads.com.
And now the spiel. It's Halloween, the one day where my nearly debilitating vocal effect is celebrated. The ironic thing is, when I'm actually trying to convey spookiness, I sound just like this. Just a flat affect. Be afraid. Be very afraid. Anyway, Halloween is supposed to be frightening, but these days, it's not so much frightening as it is fraught. Eric Erickson of The Resurgent has an article out today, headline, "Is your daughter a whore?" For me, the answer is no. But go on. Quote, "Costume makers across America seem to think your preteen and teenage daughter wants to dress up as a whore. Shopping for Halloween costumes for girls has become a ridiculous affair. If my daughter wants to dress up as Black Widow, as she did last Halloween, there were no costumes for girls her age. But if she wanted to dress up as a slutty nurse, absolutely the costume industry could help her out." Now, I might argue that a sexless, understated version of Black Widow is no Black Widow at all. I mean, I want a Batman without the cowl and pointy ears. But point taken. It is a complaint you hear often, even among more feminist circles, more feminist than The Resurgent, which is to say feminist at all. Circles where the term slut has been taken back. There, the point is that sexiness is to be celebrated so long as it's a choice. I am a come hither radish because I wish to be a sexy radish, not because society has thrust sexiness upon this heretofore demure root vegetable. And speaking of being thrust inside a Halloween costume, there is this complaint about costume conformity, as exemplified in a BuzzFeed video titled "Plus-Sized Women Try On One-Size Halloween Costumes."
Finding Halloween costumes is so hard, especially if you're plus size, because chances are they don't make your size.
They never fit. They're not very comfortable.
The fabric just tends to be terrible and itchy.
It's unrealistic.
To learn the lie of, quote, one size fits all at any point in your life is an awakening. I remember when I first cottoned to it. But to have to learn this harsh lesson on what is supposed to be a holiday, that is harsher still. Then there are the campus complaints about Halloween. At Tufts, there are forms available on a dedicated website to report offensive costumes. University of Florida reminds its students that the Student Health Center is staffed by mental health counselors 24/7 should they find any costume troubling. UMass has a simple costume racism evaluation and assessment meter, or SCREAM. The offensiveness of a costume is rated from low to guarded through elevated, high, and severe. Wah, wah, wah. Sephardic Jew dressed as Fozzie Bear, which is clearly modeled on an Ashkenazi Jew. Wah, wah, wah. So here's my Halloween thesis and how all of this relates beyond this day. To read about Halloween or to watch BuzzFeed videos or to scan your Twitter feed is to think that Halloween is a contentious, fought over, joyless holiday, problem-ween. But to live Halloween in the real world, it really is the best holiday. It is now the most popular holidays in bars, surpassing St. Patrick's Day. And it's open to every religion, except the most fundamentalist religions who don't deserve fun anyway. And there's something for every age group. Trick-or-treating for the kids, partying for adults without kids, handing out candy for adults with kids, turning off the lights and pretending you're not home for Old Man McGarver. But to hear the media portrayals of Halloween, or if you asked historians to study the written records of Halloween that are out there now, you would say Halloween is the day when everyone gets upset about the costumes that don't fit, or don't cover, or do cover you in shame. The difference between Halloween as the lived experience and Halloween as the reported on or analyzed by mass media experience is gigantic. It's a chasm, and it kind of reminds me of politics, but with one difference. The coverage of politics makes politics seem like a dysfunctional cesspool. And there are a few reasons for this. Chief among them is that politics is largely a dysfunctional cesspool. But there's also the conventions of political reporting, which can never really embrace a great idea without risking charges of bias. But of course, you could full-throatedly complain. You could say a pox on both your houses, how bad it's all gotten, as long as it's a bipartisan poxing. So politics reporting has a little in common with Halloween reporting. Oh, it's so bad. The downside is very well chronicled. But the upside on Halloween, that's really easily recognized and recognized as Halloween. A giraffe and Captain America knocking on doors collecting fun-sized Snickers. Now, that's clearly Halloween. But what's politics? What's the good side? What's the upside of politics? Winning an election, I guess, but if it's a close election, almost half the people won't even be pleased by that. When politics goes well, it doesn't seem like politics. It just seems like a life condition. Even if it was politics that brought this condition about, politics doesn't get credit. The economy has greatly improved, but when people are asked about it, they are much more pessimistic than the data suggests they should be. Or let's take something where politics are given credit, in a way. Gay marriage. There's now gay marriage, and people who are supporting that, which turns out to be the majority of people and getting larger, give credit for the politicians who are on the right side of this issue. But that goes away pretty quickly. And now, as we move towards greater tolerance, as the decline of anti-gay attitudes occur, that's seen as societal, not political. Economic gains, when they are seen as economic, not political. Apple gets credit, not the United States. Victories in war, seen as military, not political. The victories are military. The defeats, well, those are the politicians. Now, there's a couple other areas where the analysis and coverage makes the actual thing appear much worse than it is. I'll give you two examples. Parenting and college. Parenting is fun. Parenting's mostly great. You would not know that if you read the blogs or the books or the podcasts or the tweets. College is lots of fun. It's ultimately remunerative. Sometimes it's even educational. But the chatter around college, it makes it seem terrible every step of the way. The application process is awful. The binge drinking, sexual assault culture on campus. The debt is crippling. The political correctness is corrosive. So ask a college student at graduation, hey, how'd it go? Guess what? They're going to say, we had a great time. But college is recognized as college, and parenting is recognized as parenting. It's just that politics, you forget to give credit to politics when politics goes well. So this Halloween, even if your costume isn't able to cover up either your cleavage or your cultural insensitivity, know this. You are engaged in a holiday that has been bemoaned, but is clearly beloved. And in 8 days, you'll be voting for a candidate who, the polls indicate, is going to be much more bemoaned than beloved. But when you think about it, politics does deliver a lot more nourishment in the long run than individually wrapped Reese's cups. So, as me and my kids engage in the door-by-door gradual pursuit of tooth decay, spare an extra sweet tart if you come across me. I will be in a costume that unites the best of Halloween and politics. I will be dressed as sexy Mike Pence, or as I call him, just Mike Pence. And that's it for today's show. Macabre Mary Wilson produced The Gist. Chris Batrube was also the Gist's producer. Steve of Destruction Lichtai is executive producer of Slate Podcasts. Andy Boowers is chief content officer of the Panoply Network. The Gist, have a spooky Halloween, but also a verdant Sukkot. Because, you know, my voice affliction. Oom-pru-de-pru-do-pru, and thanks for listening.